From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. April 4th, 2018 marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was on a balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, when he was fatally shot. He had been in Memphis to support striking sanitation workers. Only a day before his death, on April 3, 1968, he gave this speech at the Mason Temple.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around. I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on April 3rd, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. It was his last speech given just a day before he was assassinated. April 4th of this year marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death. And his impact on the nobility of the struggle he led is no longer contentious or in question. Indeed, the civil rights movement in the United States is now held up as a model for current movements, sometimes even used to undermine existing movements for civil, political, social, and human rights. For example, the Black Lives Matter movement has been demonized by some of the same forces on the right that may laud the civil rights movement. We turn today to the author of a book that offers a realistic portrait of the civil rights movement, a book that neither romanticizes nor diminishes the movement's many tactics and struggles. Jean Theo Harris is a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College of City University of New York, the author or co-author of 7 books on the history of the Black freedom struggle and on the contemporary politics of race in the United States. Her New York Times bestselling biography, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, won the 2014 NAACP Image Award and the Letitia Woods Brown Award from the Association of Black Women Historians. Her new book is called A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jean Theo Harris.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. King is, of course, the single most iconic, most famous figure of the civil rights struggle. I mentioned April 4, 2018 marked the 50th anniversary of his assassination. He is, you know, invoked in almost this sort of holy way now, like one of the sacred gods of American history, even though at the time that he was active, especially near the end of in those last few months of his life when he began broadening his analysis, was really considered somebody who was a troublemaker. How do you think Americans in power, mainstream Americans, those who are not on the left, really need to see Dr. King's true legacy in its fullness?
I think we cherry pick what we want to see about Martin Luther King, and we miss so much of who he was, what his politics encompassed. So the most famous speech is the speech he gives on the March on Washington now, but all we hear is just the last paragraph. King is constantly dreaming. And we don't turn, for instance, to the beginning of that speech. In the beginning of that speech, Dr. King is saying that America has given Black people a bad check, and they're there to collect. If we grapple with that King that is saying that Black people are owed something, that Black people have been, when you think about what it means to get a bad check and how you redress that, right? That he's talking about real material redress.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, Black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
I think the second thing we don't grapple with in terms of Dr. King is we tend to Southernize him. King is talking about sort of racism and segregation as not just a Southern problem, but an American problem across the 1960s. He spends a lot of time outside of the South, even in the early 60s, and partly he's raising attention for the Southern struggle, but partly he's joining movements from LA to Boston. And one of the things I think we've airbrushed out is his criticism of Northern racism and his criticism of Northern allies who might be supporting the struggle in the South, but when it comes to local conditions, he says only the language was polite. The resistance was firm and unequivocal. So basically, King is trying across the 1960s not just to change the South, right, but to change the Northeast, to change the Midwest, to change the West. And he's finding a tremendous amount of resistance. He's in California in 1964 campaigning against Prop 14, which is a measure on the ballot there because to basically try to repeal in 1963, after a huge fight, a Fair Housing Act is put on the books. And almost immediately, citizens and developers get this proposition on the ballot. And so King comes to California multiple times in 64 to try to prevent the passage of Prop 14. He's constantly picketed. He's called a communist. Horrible signs. I think we forget how much King is opposed, not just in the late 60s, but even in the early 60s, and by people who might have supported what he's doing in Birmingham. But the minute he starts to talk about LA, they are not that keen on that.
Right.
And so I think grappling with that King, right, and what it means to memorialize that King and not just the King who is dreaming.
And I think so many of us today, after reading your book, would see Black Lives Matter, would see the Standing Rock protesters in a different light when they are placed within the context of a much more nuanced history, such as the one you've written. The struggle really does become more alive. And I think people can get much more wind in their sails when they see the same things that they struggle with today were faced by civil rights activists back in the day. today. So when we talk about the progress that the U.S. has made on racial justice, in mainstream America, we have this desire to feel good about all the progress that we've made. And then you have the activists of Black Lives Matter reminding us, no, we haven't made as much progress as we'd like to think we have. What are some examples of how the presence of activists like the Black Lives Matter folks in many ways reminds us of what the civil rights movement truly was?
Well, I think one of the places that we hear this criticism, right, is about how Black Lives Matter is disruptive, it's extreme, it's not going about it the right way. And these very same criticisms are used during the civil rights movement. I mean, I think one of the things to remember is the civil rights movement at the time is not popular. It's not acceptable. I think we've created this idea almost that the sort of King and the civil rights movement was acceptable at the time, and it was people like Malcolm X or the Black Panther Party that was unacceptable. And certainly there was tremendous criticism of Malcolm X, of Black Panther Party, but most Americans during the civil rights movement did not agree with the civil rights movement. In polls across the 1960s, in the early 60s, they don't think that freedom rides, that sit-ins are a way to go about sort of change. They don't think that they're gonna help. Most Americans don't approve of the March on Washington. Even if I think sometimes we would think, oh, that's just the problem of the South. In 1964, a year before the Voting Rights Act is passed, a majority of New Yorkers say the civil rights movement has gone too far. So I think the first thing, I think when we look at the ways that Black Lives Matter is often compared to the civil rights movement, one of the first things we forget is how the civil rights movement at the time made people uncomfortable. It made most people thought these were not the right tactics at the time, thought it was too disruptive. Thought it was extreme. People like Martin Luther King are criticized across the 1960s as extremists. They're treated by the federal government as extremists. They're surveilled as extremists. So I think that's one area where kind of looking at the civil rights movement helps us see sort of Black Lives Matter and other protests today differently if we actually look at how the civil rights movement was actually treated during its time.
It's interesting because obviously if the civil rights movement was popular, victory would have been quick. There wouldn't have been a struggle if the majority of Americans and politicians approved of the movement, thought that they were doing the right thing. There wouldn't have been the fact that it was a struggle suggests, of course, that it was what activists were calling for was unpopular. What they were agitating for was a difficult thing to do. So how do current fables or myths around the civil rights movement deal with that? Is it that people remember the civil rights movement as these benign sort of lunch counter demonstrations, these sort of silent acts of noble, activism that were dignified, and don't remember the blood, don't remember the dogs, the arrests, the beatings, and even the killings?
Well, I think maybe, yes. And then I would also add that somehow in our mind's eye, when we think about, right, the dignified lunch counter sit-ins, we forget that all sorts of people who would never have hit those people sitting in still didn't approve of them, right? That I think we forget about all of the people who didn't agree with the civil rights movement, who thwarted it at various turns, that were not people who would spit, who would burn crosses, but they still stood in the way of the civil rights movement. So I think that's one of the things we forget about during the civil rights movement. In the book, I have a chapter called The Redneckification of Racism, and the ways that I think we remember who stood in the way of the movement in only one form, right? The sheriff at the door of the school, right, with the tiny school kid, Black school children trying to get in. We remember it as Bull Connor, certainly these were real people, and these were some of the opponents of the civil rights movement, but people who stood in the way of the civil rights movement did a whole host of things that were not always violent, but there were a variety of tactics, of methods that people used, from asserting their political power, from what we might call now gaslighting, sort of charges of racism, saying over and over, there's not a problem, it's a problem of the students, not of the schools, right? Tactics that we're very familiar with today were also ways in the 1950s and 60s and 70s that people forestalled change then as well.
So the good American people who might not have accepted the term racist to describe themselves still stood in the way of the civil rights struggle.
Yes. Hmm. Yes.
So you open your book with the election of Barack Obama as a very important moment where, you know, we as a country began to feel we were past that, you know, chapter of ours of the civil rights struggle. What role did and Obama himself plays a role in kind of moving forward this idea that the country is better for having had the civil rights struggle and seen its victories, and now we're in a better place. How does that feed into the glorification of the civil rights movement?
In part, I think it does so by treating kind of Obama's win, right, as the kind of capstone of the struggle. So like now we're done, basically, or almost done. And even President Obama himself, in 2007, he's campaigning. He gives a very kind of important speech at Brown Chapel in Selma. And he basically says we're 90% of the way there. He uses the word 90%. So in many ways, the victory is treated as really kind of the end of the struggle. And particularly in Obama's first term, one of the few ways that the Obama administration talks about race, talks about sort of racial injustice, is through kind of memorializing the civil rights movement. And they do so in broader, more substantive ways. But at the same time, it's very much a narrative of progress. It's very much a narrative of the past. So you do not see, whether it's Obama dedicating the King statue, whether it's Obama dedicating the Rosa Parks statue in the Capitol, those moments are not used to say, look, we've had these successes, but we have this more to do, and to actually propose steps forward. That's not what those events become. They become about sort of celebrating American progress, celebrating these heroes, but in ways that treats the movement in the past and really doesn't take seriously what people like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks would be asking of us today.
Jean, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for the work you've done in putting this book together.
Thanks for having me.
Jean Theo Harris is a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College of City University of New York, the author or co-author of 7 books on the history of the Black freedom struggle and on the contemporary politics of race in the United States. On the 50th anniversary of the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we've been discussing her book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.